The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Derek Vaughan is back this week to discuss an historic debate between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley that took place at Cambridge University in 1965. For those of you who don't know, James Baldwin was a literary giant who wrote works such as Notes of a Native Son and No Name in the Street, while William F. Buckley was the renowned founder and editor of the National Review, along with being a columnist and a television interviewer on his program, The Firing Line. The topic Baldwin and Buckley debated in 1965 was this: is the American dream at the expense of the American Negro? You'll find a link to the video of the debate in this week's show notes. The video's available on YouTube. I should also point out that at the end of this episode, Derek Vaughan and I agree to have our own debate sometime in the future. Given how old this recording is, that debate should be coming up soon. It's Wednesday, July 4th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Thanks goes out to Alexander W., Taylor F., Francisco A., Zach C., and Haas D. for supporting this podcast through Patreon. When you support Zero Books on Patreon, you get access to a second podcast, the Inside Zero Books podcast, every week. Inside Zero Books features conversations that you won't hear on the main feed. This last weekend, for instance, Encore Nianmote was the guest, and we discussed the music of Pink Floyd. The week before that, Derek Vaughan was the guest, and we discussed an essay by the socialist intellectual Hal Draper entitled The Anatomy of a Microsect. The music you're listening to right now is the national anthem, played on a theremin, by Chris Tanfield at URTV Studios in Asheville, North Carolina, back in 2006. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Derek Vaughan and I discuss Baldwin, Buckley, and the American Dream.
Yeah, so let's talk about James Baldwin and William Buckley.
We both watched a debate in 1965 between Baldwin and Buckley. It would happen in the UK.
It was weirdly fascinating how weirdly familiar that debate was.
I mean, like, it was definitely of its time and not of this time. Okay,
in life. Yeah.
But it still, the dynamic was almost identical. But with the, I want to say the point out that the question that they were debating was the American dream built on the backs of black people, or at the expense of black people, or Negroes is what they said.
Right. That's definitely of its time.
But
the framing was fascinating for me. That framing, and you're right, the question was so interesting, right? Because it wasn't like, was the American empire or was the American economy?
No, the American dream. So what is that? I mean, the problem, right, and no one addressed this as far as I remember, that the question didn't make any sense because we're talking about, at the very best, a mythology or an ideology.
Yeah.
We're not talking about anything substantial when you talk about something as nebulous as the American dream.
It put me in a weird spot because, of course, you, in the broad sense, kind of agree with Baldwin. But in the specific senses, there are some things that Buckley said that I was like, as weaselly as he was being, and he was being really
weaselly. He was being a real dick.
Like, he would do that stuff where he would, like, compliment Baldwin 1 second and make an not compliment, just underhand a statement like the very next one.
Yeah.
You know, and even though some of them were true, like, I bet you won't have any problem finding any university welcoming you in the United States or Europe. And I was like, ooh, that's true. But it was, they were utterly distracting. But there were things that he said. He was like, do you think the entire system of U.S. life was consciously based on the subjugation of black people? And I was like, consciously, no. That's not how that works.
What were they asking when they asked, was the American dream built at the expense of black people? What were they asking?
I guess what I wanted them to be asking was, and this you could actually have a real debate about, and if you did, in some ways, I think Baldwin would be a clearer winner.
Yeah.
Was the American economy built on the backs of black people?
Right. Now, I think that you could just say absolutely it was.
But that's not what they were saying, and that was part of the problem.
There's this other side to it, which Buckley wants to defend, which is not just the economy, but also... I want to do Buckley impersonation, but I'm not good at it. Also, the ideals and the principles and the everyday values of the American working man and the American businessman. In other words, the way of life.
The gravamen of Mr. Baldwin's charges against America are not so much that our civilization has failed him and his people, that our ideals are insufficient, but that we have no ideals. That our ideals rather are some sort of a superficial coating which we come up with at any given moment in order to justify whatever commercial and noxious experiment we are engaged in.
Buckley kept on kind of pointing out, if the American dream was so corrupt, you would have nothing to you could possibly appeal to change the situation.
That is absolutely right. Yeah,
obviously. like,
but doesn't mean that the American dream wasn't built on the backs of or at the expense of black people, though.
Well, you can believe both things.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's no contradiction there. You can say up to now the American dream has been built on the backs of black people. At our expense, we've suffered tremendously. We've been treated as less than human, we've been treated worse than dogs, and yet what was built in those horrible circumstances has human value to it that can be applied across the board.
Right, and what was fascinating to me is like, and when these are essentially ad hominem attacks that Buckley was making, but there was some truth to them, and even Baldwin admitted it. He was like, you know, I'm here in Europe talking about the American dream, but we must admit that the corruption of the American dream came from here. But you know, he's more comfortable in Europe than the United States for a variety of reasons. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about how, you know, I have made fun of Ta-Nehisi Coates once for like going to France and then, you know, saying that, you know, he felt more liberated in France, even though France was the only place that anyone had ever actually explicitly called him an N-word to his face. But I was just like, that, you know, and I thought about that and I was like, would you feel that way if you were a black French person, would you still feel that way?
It's a question I don't know the answer to.
I don't know either. I suspect the answer is no, like that you'd be much less tolerant of that hostility towards you if you were a minority from that culture. Just like a lot of people who come from other cultures to the U.S. when they were minority cultures in their home culture feel liberated in the U.S. even though there's still racism aimed at them.
Right.
Like you see that all over the thing. It seems to be. You can deal with that because you see them as more other and thus less damaging.
Right. This is why side note, this is why when I block people on Facebook, 9 times out of 10, they're left-wingers that I'm blocking.
Well, yeah.
You know, because when they say nasty things to me, it hurts. It doesn't hurt when somebody who I don't consider part of my tribe says nasty things to me.
you should just be like me and think you're above all the tribes. Just be a super people accuse me of being super snobby, and I realize, you know, they're probably right, because this is a coping mechanism, because it makes all your insults at me not hurt. It's just like, yeah, I'm not of your tribe anyway. That's okay, pleb.
I'm no longer part of the science fiction writers tribe. We need to pin down what William F. Buckley thought he was defending. Okay.
Yeah, I actually had trouble with that exactly. You and I were going back and forth on this in a way, because my first response was like, of course, in a broad sense, Baldwin's more right, but Baldwin's also like symbolizing and objectifying and painting in such broad strokes that it's hard to know.
Buckley, I think, came out and said something like he was defending Western civilization.
Right. Whatever that is.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so what is that? And this is something that is important today, right? The arguments about Western civilization. Are we for it? Are we against it? If you mean by Western civilization industrialized capitalism or post-industrial capitalism or neoliberal free market policies, then I'm against Western civilization, right? And there's a whole bunch of other things you might mean by it that I'd also be against, like homophobic insistence on certain norms around families, say.
As a person who's lived outside of Western civilization, some of the ills of Western civilization are not unique to us remotely and do not necessarily – some of them are imported from us. It's hard to tell sometimes, but some of them are not.
Right. No, I'm not even claiming that they're unique. I'm just saying if this is what you mean when you talk about Western civilization, I don't know what's really Western and what isn't, right?
Well, I got into the great argument of whether or not there's a continuity between European civilization and American civilization with, you know, that same person I was mentioning a few minutes ago.
Right.
And basically, my initial conclusion at the end of that conversation was kind of. There's kind of a continuum, but it's not – it is not as far away as Europeans would like to pretend, but it's also not as close as – everyone seems to think
as New York intellectuals want to pretend,
right? Like there is a fundamental difference at this point,
right?
And another way is like when people say Western civilization, like they don't mean Mexico, but why not? Like settler colonial civilization, you know, like that includes most of Latin America too, guys.
But I want to go back to Buckley here and just say what I think Buckley was saying is, Western civilization, the tradition that starts with the Greeks, is now expressed through American capitalism and European entrepreneurship and the ways of life and our democratic institutions and all of it. And that those who would question the economic foundation of our society are trying to destroy our way of life, and that Baldwin is in cahoots with the communists, is what he really.
Well, the funny thing is, Baldwin was in cahoots with the communists, and he walked away from that.
Right. Buckley wants to charge Baldwin with is that he is an attack that he supposedly is trying to struggle for his people within the United States, but in fact, he is struggling for another people against the United States.
Yeah, so he's really Paul Robeson or somebody, right? Like, right,
yeah, even Paul Robeson could be seen to be doing both. Okay, I mean, like,
right?
Yeah, I don't think that there was necessarily a contradiction between. I don't think that thinking of the conflict between the Soviet Union and Europe and the United States is in terms of civilizations makes any sense at all. And it's a far right wing perspective. And as far as I'm concerned, wanting to bring, socialism and communism to Europe and the United States.
Right. And that you start it with the Greeks, because the first thing I always laugh at both sides for this, you know, like, oh, white dudes are like, you know, we have a tradition going back to ancient Greece. And then I'm like, and people are like, dead white men, like the ancient Greeks. And I just want to, I just laugh. I just, because it's like,
right.
You know, ancient Greece is in fucking Libya. Like, not just, it's also in Greece, but
yeah.
It's the Greek, the ancient Greek world is the Mediterranean. And it goes all the way into like what would be, like, it affected Buddhism because they went into Afghanistan. I mean, like,
right. Yeah, right. There's Western civilization's founding, you know, come on. Right.
Like, those people weren't white, like, weird.
And
like,
you asked, you asked a Greek living in the United States, especially a left-wing one, if he considers himself white. They don't. A lot of Greek people don't.
Yeah, although, I mean, that's like Jews not considering themselves white. Well, I say this with the proper heritage to say that's bullshit, but like...
No, I understand, but I'm obviously in real political terms, like social terms today,
it's not... at best, you could say that it's a different white. It is a different whiteness.
Right, I mean,
like,
if
it's way more...
Is being goy synonymous with being white? Isn't it?
Well, I mean, but everybody who's not me is a goy. No. I mean, like, but here's the thing. Like, when we say goyish, like in Hebrew, like I say we, I shouldn't be saying this. My Jewish status is actually complicated. But, like, when we say goyish, that could mean white, or it could mean weird exotic pagan, because that's also not us. I mean... The all goy means is of the nations that are not us,
right?
And like Wakugan in Korean, it actually means pretty much the same thing. They say it means foreigner, but they'll call you a Wakugan in Koreans will call you a Wakugan in America. And they're not meaning that you're a foreigner in America. What they mean is you are not us. It is an in group out group distinct.
Right. Okay. But I find that it's often the term goy is often applied to white.
Yeah, but
more often than you wouldn't call a black man a goy if you're a Jewish American. Would you?
Yeah, you would.
Okay.
But you wouldn't.
Not to his face, maybe.
No. But
you would call a white guy a goy to his face. Wouldn't you? I mean, I've had Jewish people do that to me.
Yeah, but I mean, like, there's a big debate over whether or not it's cool to do too. Like, I mean, I'm actually very serious. Like, I mean, I think I obviously like goy is not a slur, a slur. But I mean, you know, do you call your black friends black? Well, I guess you do. Yeah. I mean, like,
right.
So, like, yeah, sure. I mean, I would say, for example, if I'm talking to someone who speaks Yiddish and I'm in a Yiddishkeit culture, and I don't speak Yiddish fluently by any stretch of the imagination, so don't get that idea. But goy would mean I refer to a black person as goy, but I wouldn't say it in English that way. Usually, I would only say it to a white person because I'm actually making a fine-grained distinction between me and them.
Right, right.
So I am acknowledging by doing that I am of a different – that I my whiteness is provisional. My whiteness has always been provisional, blah, 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 except in my case it's even more complicated personally. But, like, yes, when you get into that, it's funny. I was thinking the other day about – you know, when people started thinking about the aversion to color blindness or ethnic blindness, and I was thinking about when I was in Korea in particular the most, but also when I was in North Africa, and I would, of course, I'd notice people's race. You always do, right? But there is a point where you really, truly don't think about it at all anymore. It does fall away that you just see them as someone who is in your community, and they are part of your community.
You know who they are. You know them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you do identify them. You're not identifying them as like that black guy. You're identifying them as, say, Eric.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's not that you don't think about them being black, particularly when something that would remind you of the of that difference being pertinent would come up. But unless it comes up, you don't. And I remember realizing that for my black friends in America, that there was always something there to remind them.
This means, in the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white, and since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock, around the age of 5 or 6 or 7, to discover the flag to which you have pledged allegiance, along with everybody else, has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you.
Let's talk about Baldwin. What Buckley wanted to do ultimately was red bait Baldwin.
Yeah, red bait Baldwin and say, like, you know, basically, hey, you know, capitalism is our civilization. It's totally terrible what we did to black people. I mean, he kept on speaking out of both ends of his mouth on this.
Right.
It was awful what happened to black people, but you also don't really belong.
Did he say that? I don't
know. No, I mean, but he was trying to have it both ways. Like, he was trying to say, like, we can totally include you, but only if you, like, don't question the very foundation of the whole thing.
Right. Okay. Right. But that wasn't about – I think it's important to understand that for Buckley, that really wasn't about race. That was about questioning the American dream.
Well, I'm going to just bring in some context for Buckley. Buckley was all over the place on this question. Because Buckley, during his tenure at the American Review, I mean, despite the conspiracy theories about it being related to the CIA,
the National Review,
Buckley was kind of the arbitrator of what was acceptable conservatism, and when he declined, neoconservatism sort of took over as that, although it's not anymore. But he did kick out a lot of people for racism. He also, however, supported segregation explicitly for a long time. And
he did so on the basis of the rights of the entrepreneur, on the rights of the business owner.
The same reason that Goldwater did it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that that's justifiable or not racist. I'm just saying that he didn't do it based on an overtly, straightforwardly racist justification.
But he didn't kick – I mean, he kicked Sam Francis, who was one of the smartest and most dangerous right-wingers I've ever read, actually. Like, when people talk about the right-wingers they're impressed with, and I always tell them, if there's two people you really need to read if you want to understand what scary right-wingers who are smart think, maybe three. And those are – Sam Francis, Paul Gottfried, and
Nick Land.
Actually, I don't think. Nick Land's another crazy thing, but
I'm just kidding.
I'm trying to think of who I'm thinking of. Carl Smith, obviously. And then maybe Pat Buchanan would be a force, if I was going to tell you, because he's the closest to a normie that you can get in that sphere. That said, Buckley kicked Sam Francis out for being racist. He kicked Joe Sobern out for being an anti-Semite. I mean, like, it was in Buckley's spirit when they removed John Derbyshire from the relationship to the National Review. And so Buckley, in this weird way, in my mind, provided cover for kind of soft racialism, but explicit racialism he would pretty much anathematize and make it very hard for them to publish.
let's start to talk about Baldwin, because we talked a lot about William F. Buckley now. But what was Baldwin's argument? I mean, it was, first of all, started from his person.
Those lines were rhetorically moving.
He was moving. No doubt about it.
And also somewhat true. I mean, I'm sure he did give the time period to, I'm sure he did pick the cotton.
I don't know if he literally did, but because he wasn't necessarily speaking from always from direct personal experience. But well,
there was this weird, he tended to do this, and this was something that I did get annoyed with. What, he would speak personally, but as for his entire people, in a way that I've always found suspect when anybody does it for any reason. Like, because you can conflate things that happen to you to everybody, and vice versa, you conflate things that happen to other people to you. But in a broad sense, he's still, like, I get it, it's still true. And it was definitely living memory in Baldwin, when Baldwin's talking about it in 1965. The lynchings are still fairly fresh.
Yeah, they're still happening.
In 65, people are disappearing on the freedom rides, like, and never being seen again, both black and white, but for black people. You mean, like, in a way, and this is something that we kind of forget because the rhetoric feels kind of – I think Baldwin's rhetoric feels particularly familiar to us because it's so close to Ta-Nehisi Coates. When Buckley challenges Baldwin, and because I really – what I didn't get about what Baldwin was demanding.
But what was he demanding? What was his argument? What was Baldwin's – I mean, he spoke about the repression.
He seemed to be demanding, you know – that people just own up to it, I guess. But that was where I was confused.
The problem, like, again, was that the way the argument was framed.
I mean, he wasn't even making like Ta-Nehisi Coates' kind of fairly symbolic reparations argument, you know?
No, he was arguing that the American dream was built at the expense of black people. That's it. That's what he was arguing, right? It was for that side of the debate. But what did, again, because of that, if you say yes to that, you don't, that's very nebulous.
Yeah, what is so, it? And that's where I felt very frustrated. Because I'm like, and this is where I told you I was kind of sympathetic to Buckley in a sense, because he's like, you know, because Buckley does say, even if you're completely correct, what could we possibly do? If it's all, you know, this is where he went to web baiting. But if it's all just, you know.
Yeah, this is where he goes to web baiting, is when he says, what do you want us to do? And the truth is, I think Baldwin does want to go socialist.
Right.
I think Baldwin does want to say we have to undo this, that we have to, because I think Baldwin talks about common ground between white and black working people in his
he does side. And he does I mean, he does think that there's real ground to be there. I mean, and to be fair to even someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates thinks that too, although with the election of Trump, he did basically come out and in some ways he's sub-Baldwin, because he basically came out and said, well, you know, even if there is real parity between working class white people, working class black people, working class white people don't vote, so this is all an upper class white game. Like, that was Coates completely said that. I don't think Baldwin believed it. The thing is, though, and it we're not talking about here with Baldwin, is Baldwin was going through his own disillusionment with the Soviet Union too, and so, like, I think he was in some ways he wanted to go socialist and wanted to play that up, but he also doesn't know what kind of model to base it off of anymore.
Right.
And he actually really isn't in league with the Reds, in the sense of being in league with the Maoists or the Soviets. But he doesn't know where to go.
Exactly. Yeah. He didn't have. There was no. The problem was they were debating something that didn't make any sense, and the real debate needed to happen on a different level.
Right. Like, so let's say the American dream is broken because but you and I have gone back and forth, because I will argue with leftists who say, well, capitalism is inherently racist. And I'm like, inherently or accidentally?
Yeah.
But I don't mean like accident, like, oh, it was an accident that people were racist around capitalism. I mean, is it an incident to, or an accident? Is it adjacent to
I would capitalism? Say opportunistically racist.
Yes. Okay, yeah, because I'm using really technical terms, so that's a better way. Is it opportunistically racist, or is it somehow – because the idea that – because capitalism emerged arguably in Europe – well, maybe not arguably, although there were precursors to it in other places.
Right.
That it somehow inherently – because it actually doesn't seem like it was inherently based on a racial – particularly in the specific instances in which it arose in the in either the Italian banking system or in the English agricultural reform. Neither one of them seemed to actually have been that very, very racialized, like at all.
Right.
So I don't know that you could say – that capitalism is inherently racist to by its own logic. And also it would imply that there can't be like, you know, minority capitalist countries, which I think is objectively false. So,
right.
There totally are. And so like, what does that mean? And I don't know what it means.
I try to imagine what debate would have been more fruitful at that moment. And also what can we get out of watching that debate now? And I think that in that moment, debating with William F. Buckley might have been necessary, but wasn't sufficient, right? I mean, in other words, I, as a leftist, want to see James Baldwin debating with someone who, on the grounds of how do we do something about capitalism.
I know this debate exists too, but I've never watched it or read it. But I know Baldwin did debate Malcolm X.
There's really too much and too little to say. What is the issue here? Malcolm X wants us to act like men, and it seems to me, one of the things that I object to here, I don't think that the fact that white people have done what they have done, Patrick Henry is not one of my heroes. I'm sorry. Most of the American heroes have never been in my Hall of Fame. I don't see any reason for me, at this late date, to begin modeling myself on an image which I've always found, frankly, to be mediocre and not a standard to which I myself could repair. I don't think that black men now should be, because white men have committed these crimes, that black men should do the same thing. I think that there is something absolutely insidious, even if I cannot make this absolutely clear, there's something, to my mind, always terribly insidious in the whole question of race. The white man's racial characteristics, in which the white man claims to be so proud, have reduced him in this country to incredible levels. There is nobody in the world, I think, sadder than a white man in the deep South who only has his skin and his blue eyes and his yellow hair and nothing else. I don't think that I want to go through the world, and I will not encourage my nephew to begin to go through the world only armed with the color of his skin. The only thing that really arms anybody when the chips are down is how closely, how thoroughly he can relate to himself and deal with the world, yes, as a man, you know. But I don't think, I think when I talk about standards, I say they all got to be revised. This is one of the standards that has to be revised. I don't think that a warrior is necessarily a man. And in fact, it has been proven that football players and all these people in teams and in armies are not men. It is very difficult to be a man. And what it involves, for me, anyway, is an ability to look at the world, to look at whatever it is, and to say what it is, and to deal with it, to face it, even if it does mean laying down your life, because in a way it always does mean that.
Do you think that there's something to learn from this James Baldwin-Buckley debate, that people would be well off watching it today? Or?
I think they would be, and I think what they watch for is I think everybody who watches it today, I mean, I get this from reading YouTube comments and from everyone commenting on my wall, because they were surprised when I did not sing James Baldwin's praises immediately. You know, a lot of leftists. And I'm like, but the thing is, like, even if I agree with him, and I think even that debate, he was stronger. But the question was so wrong. The question was wrong.
Yeah.
The question was so wrong that you couldn't go anywhere with it. So, like, you were just stuck in what to do now. And the idea, you know, like, even if you win James Baldwin, what do you do with the American, like, so what, we need a new American dream. What is that going to be?
And you go down as a great literary figure.
Right. But
that's all you win out of that debate. You beat William F. Buckley in a debate, rhetorically mostly, and you are lauded. But and so Buckley's right about that, actually, right? I mean, that is a point he has. The problem is Buckley is defending, ultimately he's defending what's indefensible. He can't help but defend the exploitation and oppression of black people by trying to reject that notion.
Right, and he's also he tries to have it both ways, but ultimately you're completely right. And the other thing, really, is that what he's defending isn't real. Right. Like right. A unified Western civilization like that isn't real. I mean, this is when I debate rightists, this comes up a lot in my conversations with rightists. When they talk about like we need to save Western civilization, and I'm like, from what itself?
Yeah, I mean, Western civilization was within living memory, barely at war with itself.
Yeah, I mean, and also, let's talk about this for a second. Like, the civilization that you are think is being degraded and degenerated is being degenerated by the very values produced by that civilization.
Right. Exactly.
So, what you would. God, this will bring up an unfortunate thing. I think that was part of Michel Houellebecq, and he's a reactionary. Don't get me wrong, but right. When I was reading Submission, and I was like, he talked about how originally he wanted I was reading an interview with him about Submission. Originally, he wanted him to become Catholic, but it wasn't viable. And the reason why it wasn't viable, if you're trying to run to tradition from the fear of nihilism, even opportunistically, which is what Submission is really about, that you're going to run to something outside because the inside thing is totally decadent. But ironically, it was funny because what Houellebecq actually predicts will happen is, it's actually like sex that gets this guy to convert to Islam. Not anything very serious, but that it's actually a sign that nothing's going to take anyway because it's still decadent. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is Houellebecq's thesis in my reading of that book is that Western civilization may not be worth defending. The reason why it's dying is – and I don't see this as like an admiration for – I think he's – some of the criticisms of Islamophobia stuff are true. But that, like, he's the reason why he can't make that character Catholic is he's like, well, those values are values that led us down this path anyway, because, France is a Catholic country and blah, blah, blah. And if it, like, this secularism extends from a problem in that in the first place.
Well, right? Also, it's important to the reactionary move that I think happens is that they conflate capitalism and its contradictions with egalitarian values, democratic values, the Enlightenment in general. The question is the American dream, if you really go broad, is the American dream built at the expense of black people, can be read to be, are these values, these Enlightenment values, I'll say broadly, always necessarily built at the expense of the other, whatever that other might be? And can we have these values without something like capitalism?
Ooh, gosh, this actually might put you and I at odds.
Right.
Exactly. I think this is a great debate between, if there's a real.
And this is where I fall down on the side, kind of
Buckley.
Buckley.
And where I'm like, I guess maybe ultimately I am more of a Horkheimerian, where I'm like, yeah, the dialectic of enlightenment is impossible to maintain.
I think that is a real high level debate that's being had between Baldwin.
Right, but they're not having that debate, nor are they having the low level debate, like
about capitalism or
about capitalism or even specifically American capitalism,
even policy.
Right. Right, so you're not. It's in this realm of abstraction that is, in this weird sense, not abstract enough.
Right,
but also not specific enough. You're just kind of. It's like neither warm, neither cold nor hot. So I spit you out.
It's mythic.
Yeah, it's mythic, but not totalizing. Yeah, that's the way I'm trying to use my Hegelianese for.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not doing well with my Hegelese on this one, but I just think of it as they're talking about mythic values and glosses and impressions.
And it's not that I don't think mythic values are important, but you can't start there.
Well, you can start there. You can't stop there. You know, you can't, you can say, okay, if you're going to debate the American dream, you have to then ask, what is it?
Right.
You know, and what do we mean? And define it. And then
was it always capitalism? You know, like,
was it always capitalism? Does it always have to include capitalism? You know, and that's where you and I might differ. Now, I will say, like, you and I might differ, not, but it's not like I'm constitutionally married to this notion that, look, before I was a Marxist, I was a surrealist, right? There's a romantic streak in my thinking. It runs pretty deep. So I'm not, like a new atheist here. So, you know, so.
Right. And whereas, like, I am A, kind of sort of a little bit religious, and B, like, weirdly, because I'm always accusing you of being crypto religious. And B, even more importantly, I tend to think, and we've talked about this before, but that if you look at the values of the Enlightenment, that they would have always conflicted. I'm not sure another system other than capitalism that came out of the Enlightenment could win, but let's say it did. I still think we would have had, it wouldn't have been the conflicts we have now, but those values would have still come into conflict. And they would have emerged out of things that are probably material, because that seems to be the way the world seems to work. So, you know, and that's where the base superstructure stuff, but that lonely last instance, you know, where the base is utterly determinate is often obscured.
Do you want to do the debate? I mean, do you want to, like, you and I in a future podcast just, like, marshal our forces and make the arguments that we can?
About whether or not we think the Enlightenment is a good idea?
On whether or not the Enlightenment values, and we'll have to label what they are, we'll have to be clear about what we're talking about here, not this gloss that I presided today, but whether or not these kinds of values could be maintained under another sort of social order, with a different economic base.
So the argument would be basically, is it the contradictions of capitalism? Is it the contradiction of capitalism alone? Because we're going to agree that capitalism are a problem, so we have to be very specific. Or is there a fundamental contradiction in the ideas from the Enlightenment that would have led to things like we see in capitalism?
Right. Now, look, and I want to be clear that those ideas what I'm going to say in my argument is that those ideas can't be conflated with superstructural inactions of those ideas under capitalism, that you have to be able to take the ideas in the abstract.
Right. So it would not be a debate where I just flood you with historical data,
right.
Which I could totally do, but I actually agree with you, would not necessarily be helpful. I mean, like Dominic Lacerto does that with his liberalism account of history and makes some great points, but doesn't necessarily get to the heart of the matter. Sure, that'd be a debate worth having.